This Rising Coaches podcast is brought to you by Connor Sports. Connor Sports is the industry leader in playing surfaces. Whether you guys are putting together a new practice facility, a new home arena, you need a new playing surface, rubber, hardwood, top of the line, more affordable, Connor Sports has you covered. They are the best of the best. They have the best products, the best floors. You can see their courts in the NBA, the FIBA World Cup, the NCAA tournament, men's and women's Final Four, or you can probably find their surfaces at the neighborhood YMCA or high school or middle school. They're the best. They're everywhere. Connor Sports, where champions play. Thanks for listening to the Rising Coaches podcast. This is Adam Gordon, and today's episode is a fun one. We sit down with Rising Coaches co-founder Andy Farrell, currently with Dayton Men's Basketball. He is fired up to be part of Anthony Grant's new staff there, and really a great conversation. Andy has been on the fast track in Division I basketball, has worked for VCU, has worked at Dayton, has worked at Clemson, DePaul, was a Division I assistant at Longwood University at a very young age, and then kind of stepped out of the spotlight and took a job at a junior college, Southwest Mississippi Community College, where he worked for Thomas Gray, and they had a lot of success there. But, you know, we talk about how that transition and that job and those 3 years in Mississippi really were vital to his development and really turned him into the coach that he is today. Then we get into some good X's and O's stuff and some discussions about defense and player development and special situations. We hope you guys enjoy, and thanks for listening. All right, joined here now by Andy Farrell. Andy, thanks for coming on the podcast.
I appreciate you having me. Thanks, Gordo.
Yeah, man. All right, let's talk about your new job. You're now with Dayton Men's Basketball. Yep. And your previous job before that was at Southwest Mississippi Community College. That was your first experience at the junior college level. Talk about what that experience was like. And I know we've talked before, and you always talk about how much you loved that experience and getting those reps on the court. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think, like you just said, it was the best thing that could have happened to me. I thought it was just an unbelievable opportunity. And obviously, every situation is going to be different. So, like, I was very, very fortunate to have a head coach in Thomas Gray that, like, truly, truly believed in me and my ability to coach. So he kind of just handed me the reins. Like, he said, you know, multiple times in front of a lot of people, like, I mean, I was his co-head coach. Like, he didn't consider me an assistant coach. I was like his co-head coach, and he treated me like that. That wasn't just, you know, talk. Like, that's how he operated. That's how he expected things to be done. And that was the level of accountability that he made me have. And he gave me a ton of responsibility in the program. So, I mean, you're talking about literally running defense however I wanted to run defense. Like, during the game, ideas off one another, but ultimately he always said, hey, like, it's your call defensively, whatever we're going to do, however we're going to change things, however we're going to scout, it's going to be completely up to you. So having, just like you said, those reps, like getting those reps in of on-the-court coaching, preparing practice, preparing every scouting report we did for 3 years, I thought all that was really, really important for my growth as a young coach. And it was exactly what I needed, especially, you know, it was only my second assistant coaching job, and to have that much responsibility and to be getting those reps in practice, in games, was just truly valuable to my growth as a coach. And obviously I've got a long way to go, but having that type of responsibility for 3 years, I don't think that can be replaced. And again, like, not every boss is going to be like that, but Coach Gray was so humble in his approach, saying like, hey, listen, like, I trust you, I believe in you, and it's not about him, it's not his, you know, he was just saying, you know, it's about the program, and he was going to take offense, and he trusted me to take the defense, and I give him a lot of credit for doing that. And we'd have a ton of Division I coaches come to our practices,
and they would sit down with me afterwards, or our coaching staff, and like I, and they said that I, they've never seen a junior college or high school run like that, where the head coach gave so much responsibility to an assistant coach, and that's complete credit to him and the way that he operates and his management and leadership style.
You worked at Dayton, VCU, Clemson, DePaul. Was it hard going to the junior college level after being at that high level, the highest levels of college basketball?
Yeah, initially, and I'm not gonna lie. Initially, it was very difficult. Like even the thought of coaching at a JUCO was difficult for me. Like all, you know, just like everybody, all growing up, when you start getting in this gig, you think to yourself, oh, high major, and like, oh, I'm gonna be the next head coach at, you know, the Blue Bloods or wherever you wanna, you know, be the head coach at, and you just think like the progress and the steps that you're gonna take are always gonna be at that high level. Like you said, I got spoiled early. Like the programs I worked at early in my career, Dayton, VCU, Clemson, DePaul, like I mean those are elite level high major programs. So even the thought of JUCO never crossed my mind. And then I got fired from my job at Longwood University. I was an assistant coach, got fired after my first year, and I had to start looking for opportunities. And the junior college route was one that was presented to me. Didn't really think too much of it. And then the more I researched it, the more I talked with Coach Gray, more appealing it really was for me. And a lot of people just kept saying like, hey, you're a young coach. You need reps. Like get on the floor, coach basketball. Like that's, it doesn't matter the level. And I was very naive, and I thought that it did matter the level. And then when I got into the junior college, I realized it doesn't matter the level, because I truly, truly enjoyed the junior college level. I recommend it for any coach, any young person that wants to get into coaching. The junior college level is an unbelievable opportunity, because I mean you may not have all the same responsibilities I did, or you may have more, but you're going to get reps. And that's just so important for the growth as a young coach, or as any coach, just getting those reps, like having to figure stuff out on the fly, preparing things and owning things just helps the growth as a coach. So I never thought I would end up at a junior college level, but I absolutely loved it when I was there. It truly was the best experience I've ever had. Again, a lot of credit goes to, you know, Coach Gray, at Southwest Mississippi Community College for making it, you know, such an unbelievable experience for me, and the student athletes that we recruited there. But I never thought I would want to coach junior college basketball, and it was by far the best thing that's ever happened to me in my coaching career.
Oh, I agree. I was lucky to work for Tim Ryan at College of Central Florida for 2 years, and it's the best, man. You do so much. You're literally doing everything. And
you're literally doing everything. I mean, you, aside from basketball, like I had to figure out, you know, academics. You had to tutor some of the guys. You had to really, really get good at learning transcripts, what transfers in, what transfers out. You know, you have to be the strength coach. You know, you have to do the conditioning. There's so many other things. And then it's the whole aspect of, you know, these guys are junior college guys, and they're away from campus they're away from their home for the first time on campus. And it's not like a Division I, II, or III staff where there's multiple assistant coaches. It's you, the head coach, and then maybe one other person. We were very fortunate to have we had a volunteer assistant all three of my years, great guys, but it's just three of you guys, you know, as opposed to some of these other staffs across the country, like our staff at Dayton. I mean, there's 11 total people on our staff, including trainers and strength coaches, but there's just three of us. So anything the guys need from a basketball standpoint, academic standpoint, but also life, you know, just trying to mentor these 18, 19-year-old kids in life issues where they're trying to, you know, come into their own and come into their manhood, and just they have problems, they have issues, whether it's at home and it's off the court or whatever it may be. Like, you are the shoulder that they cry on. They're the person that, you know, they're coming to you when they need a hug. And, you know, sometimes it's that tough love that you have to give them when they make mistakes, but your growth and the relationship that you develop, just like, I mean, you always bragged about it when you were with Tim Ryan at the junior college level. Like, you just had to be there for these guys at all times, and the relationships they develop just grow deeper and deeper.
I don't know if I bragged about it. All right, so now you had an unbelievable opportunity this summer to take a job at your alma mater, Dayton, for one of your mentors in Anthony Grant, back at the high major level, basically. What's that been like, and how's it been like going from what we just talked about at the junior college level where you're doing everything to now being part of this big, you know, mid-major plus high major staff?
Yeah, so great question. So it kind of was the perfect storm. You know, Dayton had been rolling for a while, even after I left, with Brian Gregory, and they had a really, really good time with BG before BG left to take a job at Georgia Tech, and then most recently the head coach at South Florida now. And then Archie came in to just kind of pass the torch on, and they took the program to a whole nother level. And then when he left for Indiana and Coach Grant got the job, it was kind of a perfect storm. It was a place that I had always loved. I've always held Dayton really, really close to my heart. Both of my brothers were on staff. There's been a member of the Farrell family on staff for over a decade here at Dayton. So it was a place that I've always wanted to return and coach at. And then when our athletic director, Neil Sullivan, hired Coach Grant, a guy that I worked for my first job out of college, I was a graduate assistant for him at VCU. And literally any job I've ever even been interested in, I've always bounced the ideas off of him. Him and I stayed in really, really good touch. He's been a mentor of mine, spoke at our Rising Coaches Conference, probably in our third year that we had it. So he's always been someone very, very close to me and someone that I've relied on a lot in my young development as a coach. So when he was named head coach, it was a perfect storm. It was an opportunity for me to return home when he offered me the job, and another opportunity to work for him again, which I've always wanted to do. I've always said I want to work for Coach Grant again, because not just though I think he's a great coach, but I think he's a great man. I think he's a great mentor, and I think he's about the right thing. So it was a great opportunity to come back to Dayton with Coach Grant. But like you mentioned, it's a different role. I'm the director of scouting and program development, and it's not coaching. You know, the NCAA rules can say only the head coach and the three assistant coaches can actually coach basketball. So and recruit. So it's a little bit different going from the extreme where I'm literally preparing every practice, coaching, you know, half of the practice, controlling the entire defense at the junior college level, doing every scouting report for the past 3 years, to now a different role and a different way of doing things because of the NCAA rules and the job that Coach Grant wants me to do and that I can do legally. So it's been a little bit of an adjustment, me trying to figure that out. Our assistant coaches are really, really good. So the way I've kind of taken my new job and responsibilities is, you know, some people could say, oh, well, you're taking a step back because you're not on the court or you're not on the road, you know, coaching. Like, no, not at all. It's just, it's another opportunity. And the perspective that I have is I have another opportunity to learn from three really, really great assistant coaches and a head coach that I think the world of. So instead of me coaching all the time, I'm watching how they're doing things. I'm really studying our team. I'm studying our new system offensively and defensively, the leadership things that Coach Grant always talks about. So it's an opportunity for me to take a step back in order to gain perspective, not a step back necessarily as like, you know, oh, well, you're not coaching anymore, this, that, and the other. Yeah, I'm not. But, you know, it's always learning. And us as coaches, we always talk about, we always have to be students of the game. We always have to learn. And, yeah, we do that by reading books or this, that, and the other. Well, every day is like that for me right now. I'm a student of the game every single day because the perspective I have is to watch and learn from these guys, which has been a great opportunity for me to refocus some things that may have gotten lost in the shuffle when I'm in the daily grind of everything at Southwest.
Is there anything specific that you really miss, whether it's like player development in the off season, practice every day, film sessions, anything specifically that you see sometimes and you're just like, man, I don't want to be doing that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're going to have that. So practices, like, I love player development. Like, I love being in the gym with one or two guys, four guys, whatever it may be, and perfecting the craft and just working guys out on the court. There's something about that. And that was something that I did a lot at Southwest. You know, whether it's just one or two guys and like you're just doing drills with them, you know, 3-4 days a week, and you're just seeing them get better. You're putting together a very specific plan on very specific things for their level of improvement. So that right there, I missed. But at the same time, I had an opportunity all summer and all preseason to take a step back and to watch and to learn new drills and to hear different points of emphasis with the same drills that I would do, but now it's a different point of emphasis. So like I'm honing my craft a little bit more. And then as we started practicing, like I love defense. Like it's tough to pull back from 100% in practice. Even if we were doing an offensive drill in practice, Coach Gray at Southwest wanted me to have a defensive lens. So if we were doing 5-on-5 offensive execution, I was still coaching the defense every single possession. If we were doing 5-on-0 offensive execution, when the shot goes up, I was emphasizing transition defense. So it's tough to go from 100% to zero. And as we've gotten into practice, yeah, like when we're doing drills, like, yeah, I wish I could be, you know, out there coaching up the defense and talking about ball screen coverage or how we're guarding the post, this, that, and the other. But again, at the same time, like, I'm listening and I'm learning from the assistant coaches and our head coach just about their points of emphasis, what they're touching on. And then if I see some stuff, I'll mention it to them, like, hey, listen, like, you know, we're not jumping to the ball really well, or hey, like, yeah, that action's hard to guard, but if we increase our ball pressure here, it could be really good. Hey, our transition defense needs to do X, Y, Z. So kind of almost being a second set of eyes for them whenever they're asking me for my opinion about practice, but not trying to overstep my bounds, because they are really, really good at what they do as well.
You mentioned jumping to the ball, and it reminded me that I kind of think that's the best thing about the junior college level is every year you're starting from scratch with like probably like 8 or 9 freshmen and 4 or 5 sophomores, and you literally have to go back to the basics every single year. Hey, this is what a defensive stance is. When the ball moves, you move with the ball. Ball you man. I mean, you just really get to the core of, okay, what's the most important thing and how can we teach it to these guys in a matter of 6 weeks?
Yeah, like the level of efficiency that you have to have. It took us our first year, because my first year at Southwest was Coach Gray's first year as a head coach. So like our first year, like we were kind of like trial by fire. Like we were just really just doing things and trying to figure it out. And in our second year, that's really where we got the page turned, and we had the most, you know, successful 2 years athletically and academically in the history of the program. And I think that's where the page was able to turn, is we figured out how to coach them better. Whether it was like, hey, we've got to do a breakdown drill for 4 minutes, biggest guard split, bring them together for another 5 minutes to see how it combines, and then you drill it in a live segment in order for them to understand, hey, how to guard pin downs. You know, little things like that where you're literally breaking something down and you've got to be really good with it. You've got to be quick. You've got to be efficient. And you've got to really teach like whole, part whole, part whole. We just had to figure that out. But like you said, like you're having to do that every single year because you have so many freshmen. Half your team, if not more, every single year will be freshmen. And even the guys that came back from last year's team, they had about 3 months off in the summertime. So I mean, they probably lost a lot of that too, and it's just those daily habits. So, yeah, absolutely, it's that fun part of just going back to the fundamentals and teaching the fundamentals of the game.
All right, I want to ask you a couple player development questions, a couple defense questions.
Yep.
All right, player development. Okay. Are you a reps guy, like get a lot of reps up, or are you a game speed guy?
I think depending on what it is, I think that there's value in both, and just depends on what it is. I think, you know, obviously shooting mechanics is important. I think you need to do form shooting a lot, you know, whether it's, you know, short shots, one hand shots, and then just, or slowly moving back. I think all that stuff's really, really important in terms of getting quantity reps up. But then I don't think you need to be, you know, shooting 800 shots. I think if you shoot a really, really efficient 100 shots going game speed, I think that does it too. So I think it all depends on what it is and depends on people's level. I mean, if you have some of these elite level guys, you know, yeah, I mean, you doing quantity, it does nothing. Like, you got to go quality reps, keep it short, keep it simple, and then go from there. So I think it just depends on the level and what exactly you're trying to execute. You don't want to, like, try to have someone do game speed, you know, inside out moves with the left hand if they are terrible at using their left hand. Like, no, you've got to slow that down. They need quantity of reps before they can go with quality of reps. So I think it depends on where their level is. And as you start increasing your skill level, you go for quality over quantity.
How long are you? Ideal workout, you got a guard that you've worked out before. How long are you going? Off season?
30 to 40 minutes.
30 to 40 minutes.
Because I think the first 10 minutes, like the way I like to do things, the first 10 minutes is ball handling. Like you've got to do one ball, two ball stuff, the basic stuff that you were doing with, you know, youth basketball, you know, smacking the ball around the head, one, you know, power dribble, fingertip dribble, crossovers as fast as possible, things like that. I think you just got to rep that because ball handling is so important. And then the next, you know, 20 to 30 minutes, just depending on what you're trying to accomplish, whether it's moves off the dribble, ball screen moves, shooting, things like that. Like I don't think you need to do any more than that if you just have a guy for one-on-one. You know, give them appropriate rest when they need to, so you may get closer to the 40 minutes. If, you know, you shoot free throws, they got to get a couple of drinks. But I think 30 to 40 minutes is at most what you probably need to do if you're doing a one-on-one workout. Yeah. If you got four people and you can add some competition to that, do some two-on-two stuff, you may start venturing to the 40 to 50-minute range. But again, they're not getting as many reps up, so you can probably do that.
Are you mixing in a lot of different types of finishes, or are you mostly getting, like, you do your ball handling to start, and then are you, like, getting shots and off-the-dribble moves to your jumper?
I think it depends. I think you always have to vary the types of finishes that guys use, because there's needs for those. I mean, sometimes you got to shoot the floater. Sometimes it's the, you know, same side, you know, same hand, reverse layup, same hand, opposite hand, Euro steps, although I'm not a fan of the Euro step at all. I like the 2-foot power finish. I mean, you know me, I'm all about the power game. So 2-foot jump stop, rise up. I think there is something to be said for varying your finishes. And again, it just depends on the drill. I think that, you know, you've got to incorporate that a couple of times each week, and you just tell the guys, hey, you can either freestyle it, or you can, you know, do, you know, the first two are going to be, you know, same side, you know, right hand, then left hand, then reverse with the right, reverse with the left. You can kind of game plan it, but especially in the postseason, you want the guys to kind of freestyle, have their own imagination, and try to visualize some things.
Do you ever throw out the Ron Bradley term dippity do?
No, I don't. I do not do the dippity do. Although Coach Bradley, I find myself, and I'm sure you do too, there'd be times where I'd be coaching in practice, and like I'll say something, I'm like, I literally just said something that Ron Bradley said for 5 years. And it's just like, at the time you'd hear, like, Coach, what are you talking about? And then all of a sudden, like, you say it, and it's just like, yeah, that makes total sense, and I completely get it. The best was, he would always say, like, you know, if you're defending, like, no middle, no middle, you're taking the middle away with your body, and you're taking away his first step with your mind. And I was like, Coach, what does that mean? But like, when you talk about closing guys out and anticipating, you know, the first step, it makes total sense. So
I like that.
Bradley's one of the best I've ever been around.
Yeah, Coach Bradley was the associate head coach at Clemson when we were both there. I don't remember that one. Yeah, take away the middle with your body and the first step with your mind. But I like that. It's like,
yeah, absolutely.
Some Luke Skywalker stuff right there. Obi-Wan Kenobi. All right. Defense, Andy. Post defense, yeah. I want to ask you a question. All right, the ball goes in. All right, regardless of how you defend the post before it goes in, the ball gets in the post. What are you teaching your guy to do defensively?
You got to have the arm bar. You got to have the arm bar. You've got to establish and maintain that contact with the arm bar until he faces you up. Obviously, once he faces you up, that's when you have to remove the arm bar. But in my opinion, as soon as he faces you up, you've already won, because you've made him uncomfortable. So now it's just like, it's like guarding on the perimeter, which you do every single day, but you're just closer to the basket. So then if he faces you up, your philosophy, whether you're, you know, no middle or whatever you want to do, like if he faces you up, then you got to go back to your rules as he would have on the perimeter. But as the ball's in the post, if his back's towards you still, you've got to go armbar, don't give ground. Obviously, you got to teach the mechanic of not extending your arm and equal pressure that he's given you, and try to stand your ground. And I'm trying to utilize your base. You know, you've got to be low. Low man always wins. You got to utilize base, utilize the forearm. And as they're backing you down, don't give them much ground. And as soon as they go into their move, you've got to wall up, big chest, palms behind your ears, and then, you know, force the miss. And as they are coming down from their shot, you turn, check, box them out, and then pursue the rebound.
Are you forcing a middle, forcing a baseline? What are you doing?
Yeah, me personally, Andy Farrell's defense that I coached for 3 years at Southwest, you weren't forcing him either way. The main thing was like, hey, you're not giving ground. It's like, I don't care what way you're trying to, like, I think if you say like, hey, force and baseline, or hey, force and middle, that implies that you're giving them something. No, like, their back's towards you. You've got complete leverage with where you're forcing them. You've got an arm bar. You shouldn't be forcing them anywhere. You're just forcing them to pass the ball because you're not giving any ground. So I didn't want to give our post players an out by saying, hey, force middle, force baseline. Now, here's the, I guess, the caveat to that would be when we were doubling the post. So when we were doubling the post, we jumped on his bottom side because we would double team with the four man from the high side. So as soon as the ball was in the scoring area, or if the ball was caught on the block, on the flight of the ball into the post on the catch, the post player was sliding to the bottom side and the four man was trapping from the top side. So, but that we had a specific call for that. And the guys knew, like, hey, if that double team was on in the post, you know, that you were sliding to the bottom side to take it away while still maintaining contact because we've got a double team coming from the top side.
What if the four feeds the post? Are you still doubling from the four?
You still doubling from the four. Again, like, so that was a byproduct of the teams that we played. We were really one of the only teams in the league that had a four-man that could shoot the ball. So doubling with the four-man was almost the default. If we ever ran into a situation where the four-man could shoot the ball like ours could, which we didn't ever run into, but the thought then would be potentially have a designated trapper. But even then, like in terms of consistency and just keeping things simple, my thought would then just be like, you know, just double it. And if the pass is made from, you know, the wing area and the four is going to trapper, like, you're going to have to live with a couple of those things, because if the threat is the five man down low, you're going to have to give something up. And if he's that much of a threat, the kick out to a pick and pop four, hopefully we're coming out at him hard with the closeout, and the pass is going to be a little off because the four man is going to be trapping straight down. You're going to have to live with something. I don't know if that's the best philosophy to have, but we never ran into that situation. It was always, you know, we're doubling to four because we thought that their fours were, we would live with those threes, the 3-point shots that they were taking. So we double at the top side. Whoever inbounded the ball denied, and the other two guards just eyed up on the midline.
Isn't life so much easier with a four-man that can shoot?
It's so much better. Life in general is easier with any player that can shoot.
Yeah, true. Very true. Very true.
Shooting makes the game a lot easier.
It makes coaching look very good.
No question.
All right, ball screen in the middle of the floor. All right, I'm assuming on the wings, you probably are either going to ice or hedge. Middle of the floor, how are you guarding?
Did you not watch us play? In my 3 years at Southwest, did you not, like, never come to games?
I didn't pay attention. I was at the concession stand, probably. I was eating popcorn and texting.
So, in a zone, how are we guarded ball?
I'm not, yeah, and tell me what you prefer. You don't have to tell me what you guys did at Southwest. Well, I guess that was your defense.
Yeah, no. Yeah. So, like, I prefer in general to ice ball screens in a zone. But we had essentially two ball screen covers. We hard hedge. We were hedging over where the big would hedge and the guard would go over the screen under his man. So we called it hedging over. Or we blitzed where the big stayed with it and trapped until the pass was made. And the guard went over the screen and just continued corralling. And we forced, you know, a trap. And the big did not release until the pass was made. And then we had full rotation out off of that. So side ball screens, I like hedge and I also like blitz. I just think, you know, that puts, you know, pressure on them. You're diverting them. I like all that. In theory, in basketball, you know, theory, like, I like icing. I truly do, because you're essentially, if you favor no middle stance on a closeout, and then all of a sudden a ball screen comes, now you're telling them, hey, well now you're going to force the middle. And then we're telling big, hey, you want to be between your man and the basket. In an ice, he stays between his man and the basket. But all of a sudden you're hedging or you're blitzing, and now you're taking him away from that. So it kind of conflicts with the defense philosophy that you want. However, I think on quick ball reversals, it's very hard to get into an ice coverage. So, you know, there's obviously pros and cons. If you can get really, really good at it, I think that's a challenge for teams to guard, because I don't think a lot of teams do it. You see a lot of teams in Europe doing it. You see a lot of teams in the NBA do it. When you're talking about some elite-level players that do it, and there's a reason why they do it. They keep the ball on that side of the court. They limit ball reversals, which limit rotations, which helps your defense stay intact. But me personally, I like hedge and I like blitz just with the teams that we had at Southwest. Middle ball screen, like a flat ball screen, we like to force to their non-dominant hand. Most of the time it was left. So we were just, we were forcing into his left hand. And, you know, we told our big, get to the level of the screen. You kind of, you know, corral it almost in a sense where you're kind of backing up a little bit. You don't want him to get too deep. But at the same time, our whole thing was we wanted to force contested mid-range jumpers. So as long as you weren't giving up a layup and you weren't giving up an open three, like if a kid's going to take a flat ball screen and he's going to attack an elbow jumper because our big's still backing up and our big can get, and the big's going to contest it and the guard that's guarding him is chasing behind him, if he's going to, you got to give something up. If he's going to make that consistently and beat you, like, more power to you. Like, you out game planned us, but you got to give something up. So we were fine with just telling the big, hey, be there at the level of the screen and then continue to back up, you know, stunt and get back until the guard is back, and then you relocate back to your help. Mm-hmm. But you got to give something up.
Yeah. We've kind of gone to that too, and that seems to, you know, we did our Rising Coaches retreat this summer with several NBA guys, and, you know, that's, they're kind of at the top of the profession. They're all doing the same thing. They call it the drop coverage, where it's really on the guard to get through the screen. The big's going to be there flat for a second, but his biggest thing is he's not letting the roller get below him. So he by no means is ever allowing a pocket pass to the dive. And it's really on that guard to get his nose back on the ball. And, you know, if he shoots a pull-up jumper, so be it. So
yeah, because that's the best thing that you could possibly ask for, is him shoot a pull-up jumper. What you can't have is over-helping from a wing, and now that's a kick-out three, catch-and-shoot three. And you can't have the big committing too much where it's a pocket pass dunk. So, yeah, I mean, the big's got to stay there in a drop coverage, help, but the guard's got to get back in front. Hopefully you've communicated early enough. Hopefully that guard has enough urgency that he's getting back in front, and now you're in front, your defense is attacked, you live to fight another day. Or, in my opinion, the best thing that can happen, okay, shoot the pull-up jumper. Great. The most inefficient shot in the game they're taking. Great. I'm fine with that. You're going to have to live. And if a team beats us doing that, like, I would literally, in our practices, when one of our guys would do that and they would make it, I would cheer. I would tell our defense,
good.
A team cannot beat you. Yeah, a team can't beat you like that for 40 minutes. If they do, it's a statistical improbability.
Right.
And you want to know it, fine. But over the course of all our 100 games that we had at Southwest, no team that beat us made it by shooting contested mid-range jump shots at a very high clip.
Right. Okay. Last basketball question. This is a softball for you. Okay. I know we've talked about this at length, and I believe you wrote a paper about it, maybe?
Yes, you always foul. You always foul.
No. That's not what I was going to ask you, but that's good to know. All right. You're down two. You're at the free throw line, shooting one free throw with 1 second or less. So obviously you got to miss the free throw, right? How are you missing the talk about how you're missing the free throw.
Well, hold on, Gordo. But, like, you know, like this actually happened in a little bit of a different situation for me.
All right, tell me about it.
So my first year at Southwest, last game of the season, at the start of the second half, Coach Gray gets two technical fouls, gets tossed out of the game.
Yes. All right.
So I become head coach. it's a tie game. They hit a shot with about 20 seconds left to tie the game.
First of all,
bring the ball down the court.
Let me jump in.
Did not call a timeout.
Let me jump in. I've watched this game multiple times on film. Unbelievably poised for taking over mid game for your head coach who just got tossed. And
yeah.
It is like the most intense. It's the last game of the season, and it's like a back and forth game, and goes right down to the wire. So poised, very proud of you. But go ahead. I honestly
think that you like texted me like after you saw the game. You're like, I can't believe you. That was one of the best compliments to say that I was poised.
But you looked like you've been doing it for 25 years.
It was one of those like no lose situations. Like if we lost, like, hey, I took over when you're down by 8. And they shot 4 free throws. Like, you know, it was a no-lose situation. But I appreciate that. So they tied up with about 20 seconds to go. We come down the court. We don't call a timeout. We call one of our horns plays. We get a pick and pop. shoot it, miss it, get the offense rebound. And he's shooting the ball, like, as he's, like, getting the offense rebound put back because there was not much time left. So he gets fouled with 0.3 seconds left. All right? Tie game. He makes the first free throw. I double check, make sure we have a timeout, and we do have a timeout. So I call a timeout. So we're up by one with 0.3 seconds to go. We call a timeout, and this is where the strategy comes in that you're trying to refer to about how you miss a shot. So we're literally in the timeout huddle, and I say to him, listen, miss the shot, but here's how I want you to miss it. And I say, listen, if you end up making the shot, no big deal. We're going to win the game anyways. Like, just trying to make it, you know, the worst thing that can happen is, like, he's thinking too much, and all of a sudden he gets tense, and now he airballs. You know, you can't have a violation on that. So I say to him, hey, when you miss the shot, shoot it as you normally do, but just put a little bit more arc on it than you normally do. Just put a little bit more arc on it, and that's how you're going to miss it. So you're going to miss it gently. And sure enough, we break from the timeout. He shoots his normal shot, puts a little bit more arc on the shot. He misses it, and that's how you do it. Then gives a little bit more arc on it, hits the back of the rim, and we're good to go.
It's the best. And like, so if you flip the situation where you're down and you got to get a tip in to win it, so many people go with quick. Where they try to, like, as soon as the ref hands them the ball, they fire it, and it always is, like, fired right off the backboard, doesn't hit the rim, game over, right?
Yeah, you can't do that. So whatever you cannot fire it off the backboard. Like, a couple reasons. One,
I don't understand that philosophy.
you can't do it. It's a lane violation, and the rebound that you get, it's going to be in the middle of traffic.
And below the rim,
shoot it
right?
High. Yeah, and below the rim. So shoot it high, get a high rebound, allow whatever play you're designing to take place because it's going to be a higher rebound, and then it gives you more time for your man to wedge his way under. The quick throw is, I would love, if any listeners out there and you have it on tape, I would love to see where the quick throw works.
We have 9 listeners, so all 9 of you, if you have footage of that, please send it to us. We've talked about this at length.
We would love to see it.
Yes. What else you want to talk about, Andy?
Whatever you want, man.
Tell us a little bit about taking over this program at Dayton. New staff. You know, sometimes when you take over a program that hasn't been successful, you got to come in and tear everything down so you can build it back up. Same philosophy here. Obviously, you want your own culture in place, but it's a Dayton program that's been really successful. What's that process been like?
Yes, when you're talking about, you know, Dayton basketball, it's a high major program. Like, everything about it is high major in every single way, including the success they've had. You know, one of only 19 programs in the country to be in 4 straight NCAA tournaments. So, I mean, it's really, really high major in every single way. And you have 13,000 you know, fans at every game too. So everything about it is fantastic. And like you said, there's been a high level of success there recently as well. So, yeah, I think it's a blend, really, because you don't want to, obviously, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But at the same time, like, you do need your culture, and whatever that culture is that Coach Grant stands for and that he wants to implement, you got to have that. So it's that blend, and I think that Coach Grant did a great job of just saying from the beginning, like, hey, listen, like, there's been a lot of success, but at the same time, like, you know, this is me. This is who I am. These are my expectations of what the program should be. So it's a delicate blend. And at the same time, we have so many, you know, new players. So not just in the sense where, you know, freshmen, which we do have a lot of freshmen, but a lot of players that hadn't really played. Like, we have, you know, we had a kid that was a redshirt last year that didn't play. We had another sophomore. We have a sophomore now who only played, you know, in a few minutes a game. And then, you know, we graduated 4 really, really good players that played a lot of minutes, that won a lot of games. So we don't have a ton of experience coming back. So it's that blend of, hey, listen, like, all of you guys are new, and all of you guys are new to us and our culture. But at the same time, you guys were a part of this success too. It's not just those 4 seniors that graduated that account for all the success. No, like, you guys had a vital role in all that too, but your roles are changing. And whether it's, you know, for the good or, you know, a role that, hey, you know, this is what we feel as though you need to do to be successful. You know, Coach Grant has done a great job of blending those and telling the guys what his expectations are, while still trying to figure out, hey, they were successful doing it, you know, this way. So even though that's not my style, it was successful for them. And we can't have just a complete culture shock because there is something to the way things have been done here before.
Hey, Andy, did you ever in your wildest dreams imagine that 8 years ago when we started Rising Coaches that it'd be where it's at today?
No, not at all, man. Not at all. It's impressive because, and it's a tribute to like the people that, you know, came out to our first conference, the sponsors that you know paid for, you know, a lot of it to take place as well. The speakers, you know, that kind of got the ball rolling for us as well. To start giving us some credibility. Like it's unbelievable. I mean, you talk about not just like the followers that we have on social media, or, you know, the hundreds of people that have attended the conference or the dozens of, you know, coaches that have, you know, been promoted within the profession after speaking or attending the conference. You know, it goes beyond that. It's the relationships that have been created. And, you know, there's a lot of people out there that have never been to a conference, but they know about Rising Coaches and they've read the notes. And I mean, I've gotten handwritten notes. I've gotten text messages from people just saying like, hey, I read the notes. It's unbelievable. Appreciate everything you guys do. You know, head coaches, when I meet them across the country, and it's like, what you guys do is unbelievable. I wish we had something like that when I was coming through the profession, just a resource to network, to build lasting relationships, and just to learn through the good, learn through the bad. You know, it's unbelievable where it's come from, and I'm excited about where it's going to go as well, because I think the best is still in front of us for Rising Coaches. I think that our impact has been unbelievable on the coaching profession and the individuals who have been a part of it, but I think that we're only scratching the surface, because the more and more this thing has been growing, I think that we're just getting the ball, you know, the snowball rolling down the hill. I think it's just going to keep growing, and it's going to have momentum where we can really make an impact in the profession in a positive way.
Well, there's no question it wouldn't be where it's at today and had the growth that it's had without your passion and enthusiasm for it. It's been fun doing it, and look forward to many, many more. But we appreciate you being on the podcast, man. We'll have to do it again.
Absolutely. Anytime you need me, man. Appreciate you, and hopefully I'll see you at some point soon.